back. Thank you for the Tijuana Brass. It's 9:15 roundtable Wednesday morning. Yeah, we have a panel here, and we have the Tijuana Brass. Alan Chartok is here, and I got to say, we're already at odds before the program even begins. Chris Churchill, I think, is on my side. He's from the Times Union. We're both ganging up on Alan as best we can. Jen Smith from the Berkshire Eagle just arrived. Traffic today?
A little bit.
You made it right in the nick of time. It was beautiful. Welcome all.
Just as you planned.
Do it again.
The email address here is panel@wamc.org. As we get into the program and start talking about things, you may send us your reckons. Keep your letters brief, to the point. Don't include links. One email a day.
That's and it.
What?
And what? Were you, what? And if you haven't written yet, write. Write to us. At the roundtable.
Panel@wamc.org.
Oh yeah, panel. I made the Joe mistake.
Panel@wamc.org.
Right, but it's because we like to hear from people. Not only the people who always write, we love them, but the people who don't write.
Right.
We like to hear from them too.
Okay. And before we get into the program, I know there's some promotion here that needs to be done.
Well, that's right, because today at 2:00. At the Berkshire Theater Group's Unicorn Theater in Stockbridge, there's a play, Church and State. It is very relevant to what's going on now, that a politician faces a crisis just before he gets elected. And I'm going to do the talk back along with the great Kate McGuire.
So what's the talk back? What is that?
Here's what happens.
You do watch the play, right?
You watch the play, okay. Thank God. Then, thanks to God. Then what happens is... the audience has watched the play. There's no intermission. Then half the audience,
leave.
Or three-quarters of the audience,
right.
leave.
Those who are drunk enough stay,
left,
yes.
Left on the stage.
Right.
And then, people say, I don't think and I do think and like that.
Okay, so you open it up to the crowd.
I think that's right.
So you really don't know.
Correct.
But you'll be there.
It'll be
tonight.
The Alan and Kate show.
At what time?
No, it's not tonight. It's at 2:00 this afternoon.
Oh, okay.
That's when the play goes on. That's before the audience leaves.
Okay, 2 p.m., the play begins, and then sometime after that, you'll be on stage.
Yeah, about an hour at least.
You and the crickets.
Right.
Right. Now, also, another program note here. Tonight at 7, we will air a special episode of 1A+, that'll look at the lasting consequences of removing children from their parents. The fallout from the Trump administration's policy of separating families at the border deepens by the day, and we'll talk about that. So that's tonight. In lieu of a fresh air, we will air 1A+ tonight on WAMC.
One more thing that we might mention about my rare appearance, before the crickets, and that is that it will be at the Berkshire Theater Festival Stockbridge on Route 7.
Okay.
Don't you think?
And how do people find out more? Is there a website?
No. Yes, go ahead. Berkshire Theater Festival. I think that'll do it.
Berkshire Theater Group.
Berkshire Theater Group. You're right. Boy, you're so much.
Did you not learn anything from the broad class last Friday, Alan?
Great? Didn't we have fun?
It was fun.
We had fun, and you were a great star.
The email address here is panel@wamc.org. If you want to weigh in, Trump administration officials say they haven't yet figured out how to reunite the thousands of children separated from their families at the border. Separations are a result of a zero-tolerance policy adopted in May by the Department of Justice, in which anyone caught entering the U.S. illegally is criminally prosecuted. President Trump told House Republicans he is 1,000% behind the rival immigration bills, providing little clear direction for party leaders searching for a way to defuse the escalating controversy over family separations. GOP lawmakers met with the president about an hour yesterday at the Capitol to try to find a solution that both holds to Trump's hardline immigration policy and ends the practice of taking migrant children from parents. So, Chris Churchill.
Going with me, huh?
Yeah. You look like you need waking up. By the way, and I apologize to all of the people on the panel, our air conditioner's out.
No, it's not.
No, it hasn't been working all morning. So at 9:30, we'll take a break for news. If anyone needs to take a shower, that'll be the time.
And now, that's why we sound drowsy. That's yeah.
Drowsier. Chris, drowsier. You're on.
Well, I don't know. I mean, everybody in the world has already denounced the separation policy. I mean, it's obviously immoral. It's terrible. It's awful. I don't know what else there is to say at this point except the fact that they should stop doing it.
Shoo! You're such a contrarian that you finally got on the right side.
But I mean, isn't it something in this country that I can be reunited with my lost luggage probably more quickly than I would be able to a child who was separated from their family at the border? You know, I think it's just ludicrous with modern technology that there's this much trouble, you know, getting these families together.
Well, you don't have to worry about reuniting them if you don't separate them in the first place.
Exactly.
Right. So, I mean, like, hopefully your luggage doesn't get separated from you. Just prevent the problem before they're creating the problem by separating them in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the biggest things that, you know, I wanted to look at some things historically, and I think one of the bigger issues, among the many issues that we have with just taking care of human rights and policies between borders and going to the root cause of these problems, why people are leaving the country, is just the amount of money that this country has spent historically and growing detention centers across the U.S. I was looking up some numbers last night, and it's In 1994, we only had about 7,400 beds for detainees. Now we're near 40,000 beds. Whoa. Here in the U.S. You know, what does that say? I think the Trump administration just put in a line item for about $1.5 billion in ICE funds this past fiscal year. So I think that's part of the bigger picture that's not being talked about so much, is how much is being spent, how much staffing we're putting towards this issue of something that doesn't need to happen. And that comes down to policy.
And I may add to your excellent analysis, if I may say so, is that the numbers of people coming into this country are going down. If they're not going up, they're going down. So the Trump rhetoric about all of the terrible increases and the criminals who are coming over the border and all the rest of that turns out to be,
haven't they started to go back up in recent? I mean, I think there was a big drop in Trump when Trump first.
Teensy-tiny.
But I think, too, when you look, I think, Alan, you were talking about it earlier with Dave this morning about the border wall funds and things like that, which is looking to stop immigration from Mexico. But I mean, the issue starts way before Mexico. It's if you look at the number of immigrants who are coming in, these families that are being separated right now, they're mostly from Central and South America. And when's the last time we've heard about this administration doing any sort of talks about what's going on there in terms of human rights, why people are leaving? And then you look at the narratives of, you know, why these families are saying they're leaving, and it's domestic violence issues. It's gang issues. It's a lot of, I mean, just general poverty and those issues all around. And, you know, you top that off with a story today about separating from the UN's Human Rights Council. You know, we're not solving this problem anytime soon. We're not getting involved in it.
Well, this is really all about politics as much as policy. I mean, as I said earlier, and thank you for that reference, you know, there is this business of Trump playing to that crowd who, as in every country, is anti-immigrant. It's the same thing that's happening in Germany right now. Merkel could be out as a result of what's happening. And he knows who his audience is, and he's going to keep playing to that audience. He also reminds me a little bit of a two-year-old who gets into a funk and can't get out of it. And you know, everybody and the guys, the feckless guys in the United States Senate, Republicans, don't have the guts. They all agree, hey, we're going to be facing elections. We could lose our house as a result of this. You got to change it. And he says no, and they're scared of him.
But this is a refrain, I think, too. And sorry to cut
you off,
okay. Chris,
okay.
But
yeah.
I think it extends beyond this current administration. I think there's been a lot of piecemealing for decades of saying, like, well, we're going to do this. I mean, if you look at the Obama era, you had the whole ACLU lawsuits against the quote-unquote baby jails in Texas, where they were detaining mothers and children with around the 2014-2016 influx from, you know, Argentina and those parts of South America of migrant families. I think this extends beyond the administration, and every administration keeps inheriting
more issues of with bad policies.
Well, it's similar to what I was going to say. I was going to say that, you know, neither party has addressed this or fixed this for decades now. And I think in a lot of ways it has allowed that anger that Trump's playing to grow. I think that the reason the anti-immigrant sentiment is so strong is that people have gotten more and more and more frustrated with what they see as a broken system, you know, in a whole bunch of different ways. And I think both parties have failed to address this for different reasons.
I'd love you to go into the different reasons, but it seems to
me... Well, I think Republicans have always made a big stink about immigration publicly, but privately they played a corporate interest that are happy to have the cheap labor.
Sure.
And, exactly. You know, I think Democrats play more of the identity politics game where they're trying to play to Hispanics who are recent immigrants and court their votes by seeming to be more lenient on immigration. But the long-term effect is that it just neither party has been willing to address the issue.
So what would the two of you brilliant columnists say here about what should be done?
There is no easy solution, but one thing I have always thought made sense was to go after employers who hire undocumented immigrants more than going after the people themselves.
They have another name for those people. They call them voters.
Yeah.
You want them to go after their...
Go after the corporations. Voters. I mean, most times when they raid a place, you know, the slaughterhouses or whatever, that hire thousands of undocumented workers, the corporations get a little slap on the wrist and the people suffer. I think if... Part of the reason people come is because they know they can get jobs here. In fact, some of these companies even advertise in Mexican newspapers saying, come on over, we have jobs for you. Mm-hmm. Well, crack down on that, you know. Don't crack down on the people. Well,
when you're looking at border issues, I mean, really put some time and energy on the smugglers that are contributing to this. If you want to really truly create legal pathways, you have to stop the smugglers of humans, just like you have to stop the smugglers of drugs. You know, that's part of the problem too. But again, I will continue to argue that this nation has historically been lax on really taking strong stances and putting out strong sanctions on human rights issues.
So how come we have, in your words, been lax on the people who are doing the transporting? Why is that happening?
If I were an immigration expert, I'd probably have better insight because I'm not sitting at those tables. But nor do I really see it on any agendas. I've never seen an executive order, stating any action. I'd have to look at things like if you look at immigration funds. Especially between 2014 and now, how are they allocated?
Well, you know, it's pretty complicated, isn't it? Because on the one hand, if they're coming over, and as Chris and you both made the point, we want them on some level. We want them in the factories. We want them picking the fruit. We want them in this other thing. But on the other hand, Trump has to play to that base to say, this is terrible, terrible, terrible. So maybe that's the reason we don't put a stop to it.
Well, and I think also when DAPA and DACA, both policies that were meant to kind of, you know, address some of the flow of people coming into the country, they weren't upheld through Congress. And I think that's part of the issue, too.
Which reminds me, you got 50 senators who are now saying we got to do something about the kids.
You want to take this?
Is that ringing?
Yeah, that's ringing.
That's ringing?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, this is a good time to...
We can't talk on the air, can we?
No, sir. No. And actually, we're going to
Hello,
Kate.
We're going to take
goodbye.
Chuck
yes,
is in the mail.
We are.
We'll take a break here and remind you tonight at 7, we will preempt Fresh Air to bring you a special entitled 1A+. It's a special episode of 1A+, addressing these issues we've been discussing here on the roundtable. The email address is panel@wamc.org if you want to send us a thought on the discussion today. We are joined by Berkshire Eagle reporter Jen Smith, Times Union columnist Chris Churchill, and WAMC's Alan Shartok.
And Kate McGuire from the Berkshire Theater Group.
She's not here.
She was on the phone.
All right. We'll be right back. Really? Tijuana Brass. Joe gets like Coltrane, and I get the Tijuana Brass. Thanks a lot, Mike Bowen, our engineer. It's the Roundtable on WAMC. 9:34 is the time. It's a Wednesday, and boy, the studio is sweltering.
I find it remarkably comfortable.
Your mic's not on, but actually, that's refreshing change. Oh, there he is. Go ahead. Say it again.
My mic's not on?
Yeah, now it's on.
Yeah. Boy, they treat me terrible around here.
Anyway, it's warm in here. The air conditioner's not working. Jen Smith is here, and she's wearing like a coat and a sweater.
She's
wonderful. And Chris Churchill is here, and Alan Shartok as well. You can join in the fun, hopefully from an air-conditioned room, by emailing us at panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. We have letters.
Okay. Good morning, panel. Yes, the talkback for BTG's production... is an open discussion where the audience participates. Having viewed a couple already, it won't be Alan and Kate and Crickets, as Ray suggested.
Oh.
Okay. The discussions are very lively, with Dr. Chartok will probably be livelier than usual, and that's from Eric, who happens to be married to Kate and a great director himself.
Yeah. All right, sorry, Eric.
So, no, I'm not sorry.
I apologize.
Don't. And Timothy says, detainees. Good morning, panel. I'd be quite interested to hear your responses to the arguments in support of splitting up children from their family. What about, for example, the 10,000 children detainees who were sent by themselves? And is this simply a negotiating ploy by Trump to distract from the collusion issue and Manafort and get the wall built? And that's from Timothy.
I'm not sure I entirely understand.
Well, I didn't read it particularly well, but yeah. And he didn't write it particularly well. So there's all kinds of, you know,
stuff. You want to take a minute and digest it, Chris? We certainly have time.
No, but basically he wants to know what we've all been talking about. You know, is this a distraction?
Well, the arguments in support are that it's a deterrence, right? I mean, the argument is that if you're cruel enough, people will stop coming. I mean, that's... There are a lot of things you could do that are cruel that might stop people from coming. That doesn't mean you should do them. I mean, should we chop off their hands too when they cross the border?
You're also responding with cruelty to people who are often leaving cruel situations. So you get people who are already traumatized, and you put them through another kind of trauma. And from a human rights issue and a child welfare issue, since the writer mentioned specifically unaccompanied children, that's not going to make a better society for anyone.
Well, and also deterrence doesn't work as well when people are desperate, right? I mean, if people are leaving a desperate, horrible circumstance, they're going to come probably no matter what, no matter what you do to them, you know, because they don't really have a choice.
Being locked up behind fences is better than being beaten to death in a lot of cases. Or, if you look at these narratives, it's really atrocious, the human rights violations in their countries of origin.
Don't you think there are some people, as Mario once said to me on a tape early in one of our interviews, that people come here just because it's better here, just better? It doesn't have to be that they're being beaten up, which is your narrative that you're talking about right now, and certainly there's an awful lot of that that goes on. But aren't there some people who just come because it's better here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are. I mean, Jeb Bush, when he said in the 2014, I think in 2014, that people come out of love, you know, he was routinely mocked for saying that, but I think there's a lot of truth to that. A lot of these people do come because they love their children, they love their spouses, they want to give them a better life, and that makes sense. That's, I mean, that, in a lot of ways, that's the American story.
That we are a nation of immigrants, right. No question about it.
And I think, you know, it's also just people, whether you're looking to make some sort of livelihood, you travel for that. It's the same reason why we send a lot of workers over abroad to find employment there. You go where the jobs are, even beyond just leaving a country for fear. There's myriad reasons why people migrate from one place to another.
But what is extraordinary is how many people whose parents and grandparents arrived here, and somebody's at the other end and typing out already, but they did it the legal way, but the impetus is the same.
Mm-hmm. I mean, none of this means that we have to accept everybody or that we can accept everybody. I mean, we can have an honest policy discussion about levels of immigration and what works and what doesn't work, but none of, you know, that argument can happen. It doesn't mean that we have to be cruel to people who are coming now.
Well, I think that is essential, and you're so right about that. Kristen says, 100 shelters list. I'm trying to find out where the 100 detention shelters are for the migrant children, though Paul Tonko's off through Paul Tonko's office and ICE. The coverage of these shelters is so different between Fox and MSNBC that I want to actually go and see one for myself. I am just sick about this. And Kristen, you are not the only one. Mm-hmm. You are quite right to say that. But I know people who really cannot sleep over this, and it's not made up stuff. They just can't get it.
You know, if anybody wants to see an immigration shelter, all they have to do is travel about 200 miles to the north, where something like 8,000 people have crossed from New York into Quebec in the last 4 or 5 months. It's interesting that the southern border is getting so much attention when the northern border has many of the same issues, although on a little bit of a smaller scale. But, you know, the Canadian government has camps set up in Quebec, just outside of Plattsburgh. But they're humane places. They're not separating families, children from their parents. They may not be luxurious, you know, accommodations. People are sleeping on cots and various things. But the Canadian government is at least trying to treat them with basic human respect.
And I think that's going off that too, it's how people are treated upon arrival, how the documentation process is going, how you make sure families are connected. When less than 24 hours, children are completely separated by, you know, hundreds of miles from their families. I mean, that just seems wrong and suspect. I mean, what's the purpose? And I think also just the way families are told, well, if you can track your children by calling this number, there are better ways of tracking things. We know that from just the shipping and mailing industry. You know, if you give a parent and a child the same barcode, you could keep them connected and make sure in their system that the paperwork's all correct, instead of saying, call this hotline, wait however many minutes it gets to talk to someone who can speak the same language you can, to try to explain your situation when you don't have a lot of information to go off with to begin with.
Who would you guys, I'm sorry for interrupting, and it's a brilliant analysis as always, Jen, but I wanted to ask you guys, what would you do if you were a Republican senator right now, and you know that your lunch is being eaten because you could lose an election? We have one of the most miserable characters in the United States Senate is Ted Cruz. And Ted Cruz obviously sees what the political ramifications. He's in a fairly contested election down there in Texas. What would you do? Are you going to tell me that you would like to think that you would have, you know, some...
Well, Ted Cruz denounced the policy, right? I mean, yes, I think he was silent for a few days and then denounced it.
That's my point.
But I think what I would do is, it's not that complicated. You just immediately introduce a bill and vote on a bill that would ban the practice of separating families.
But for some reason, they can't get from A to B to do that.
Yeah, that's the easy solution. It's not, you can go around the Trump administration. You don't have to rely
that seems like personal ego and fear getting in the way of doing the right thing.
But not so fast, because we now know that so many people have such an affinity in the Republican Party for Trump that if any of these people face a primary, we've already seen it, they lose. And they don't want to lose their seats. It's that simple. There's no such thing as a profile in courage when it comes to these characters.
That's true, though. But for Ted Cruz and most of the other senators, the primaries have already happened, right? Mm-hmm. So they're beyond that. And also, if the vote is unanimous, which it seems like it would be, I haven't seen anybody say that this is a good practice. Mm-hmm. If the vote is unanimous and every Republican votes a certain way, you kind of have some protection.
Well, you had Mitch McConnell getting up the other day and saying we got 50 votes. In other words,
right.
There's a unified conference, and yet they can't get to do it. And their fear.
But I think the last night, the directive, you know, from the meetings was to Congress and the GOP to show a bill. So they have to do their job now and put together a bill and put it on the table in a timely fashion.
Well, they've got those two bills, one of which is draconian, the other of which is a so-called compromise, which gives them the money for the wall. Now you get Chuck Schumer. What does he do? Does he come in and say, okay, we'll give you the billions for the wall? Or does he say, no, that's unacceptable, which I suspect is what's going to happen?
Well, and that's where things get complicated, because everyone wants us to be a much bigger bill that supposedly fixes the problem. But I'm talking about just a quick bill that just bans the practice of separating families. I mean, that would take care of this one issue immediately and reduce the heat a little bit so they could maybe work on some of these other bills or mm-hmm. or put them off for another few years like they usually do.
But, Chris, aren't they scared to death of you know, there's a big Freudian slip there. Aren't they scared? Aren't they scared to death of Trump?
Yeah, they are. I'm sure they're terrified of his tweets. But is Trump, I mean, Trump and Cruz have kind of a long, fraught relation, yes. weird history anyways. But,
yeah.
I mean, is Trump going to go after, going to tweet attacks on Cruz at this point?
Absolutely. That's the one thing we know he will do.
Well, why? That means mm-hmm. Cruz will lose to a Democrat in November.
Because he has to make the point and show them that he means business. That's what totalitarian types do.
Well, if he gets Beto O'Rourke elected because Republicans stay home because they think Trump hates Cruz, that's not going to help his long-term prospects.
Chris Churchill is on the panel, Alan Shartok, Jen Smith, and you at panel@wamc.org. We have a whole stack of letters, and we will get to them. We'll take a quick break and then probably, presumably, some more Tijuana Brass music, and then back in we will come.
I love that music.
I feel like I'm on the dating game. Thank you very much for that one, Michael Bowen, our engineer. It's the Roundtable Panel, 9:46 on a Wednesday morning. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue, and we have a great panel today. Chris Churchill is here from the TU, from the Berkshire Eagle, Jen Smith, and WAMC's Alan Shartok is here.
I'm also from the Berkshire Eagle.
Yes, you are. You do. You are in there sometimes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's 97 degrees in the studio, and let's go back to the letters.
Here we go. Kristen says, we did that, the 100 okay. shelters. Remember that?
Yeah.
Okay, and John says, the girls, we know where the boys are, but where are the young and teenage girls? Panel, what do you have on that?
In terms of...
Where are they? Nobody knows. We know where the boys are, but there's been a lot of to-do about what they've done with the girls, the young girls, when they've separated them from their parents, and where they are.
Yeah, I have no idea.
I mean,
I think that's the issue.
It's... Yeah. Hard to say, I think. And I wanted to go back to the last letter, too, about what qualifies as a shelter. Under previous policy, with children detainees, they're required to have licensed centers. So it could be something as small as a child care center that could hold just a few people to something larger as well. So when you look at that 100 count, be mindful that you're not looking at all that. That just means 100 warehouses of people. It's different kinds of settings as well.
They're taking great credit for their educational efforts and their medical efforts and their dental efforts. The administration saying, we do all of that for these kids.
Well,
the pictures we've been seeing do not indicate that.
I think that if you look at some of the narratives of what people have observed of the children, the biggest thing that they should be getting in there is some sort of counselors or something, because when you have familial separation, you know, children respond to having that human bond. If you are all parents, you know, you hug, you high five your kid and stuff like that, and suddenly they're separated from all of that emotion, that stimulus, they're bored, and that plays heavily on a child's mind, especially at early ages.
If you're 3 months old, you know, it's hard to believe that, you know, that anybody, you really do need that mother and that breastfeeder.
And that takes a toll on the people who are kind of caught in the middle and staffing these places too. Imagine if you're working in one of those centers and you're told not to hug a crying child or something like that. You know, that's creating a lot of additional trauma in society right now.
True. Okay, so that was John's question about the girls, and the answer is we don't know.
Yeah.
Richard says, imbalance when charged. Manafort gets a monitor bracelet, and poor women with children traveling 1,000 miles to escape terror are thrown in jail and separated from their infants for a misdemeanor that has never been prosecuted in the past. And that's from Rich.
That's a good point. I mean, there are a lot of people, a lot of high power people who, you know, are convicted of various crimes that don't go to jail immediately and are treated with a lot more decency.
Whoa, we have a lot of letters here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that was good from Richard. Now I'll wet my thumb and get to the next one.
Jen says,
policy origins. I understand this administration enacted this policy of inhumane child separation after being rejected for years. Who was it who have been proposing these actions in past administrations. When and who first came up with these horrific actions? How can we find out and get to the root of it? I mean, recently in the U.S., of course, not every other point in racist history. Anybody? Well, we do know that the Obama administration was struggling with this, but we never saw anything, nothing like this. That's
From what I understand, the policy was conceived of during the Obama administration, but then was not. They just decided it was too cruel.
Yeah.
And I don't know who exactly was the person. I'm sure that's out there publicly, but the administration rejected it.
Our friend Vincent says, the president of the American Academy of Pediatrics said that Trump's child separation policy is nothing less than government-sanctioned child abuse. I couldn't agree more. And Jonathan says, question for the panel about border separation. Dear panel, NPR keeps referring to people who enter the country illegally. Is the action of arriving at the border and asking for asylum in itself illegal? How long has this been the case? Well, actually, one of the things that the Trump people have been falling back on is that you have a right to go to an official place and apply for, you know, for sanctuary. Mm-hmm. But that people are crossing over illegally, and that is what they're finding, you know, is different from what you are indicating here, Jonathan. Yeah? No?
Yeah, it's confusing because people are crossing illegally into Canada up near Plattsburgh too, and they're actually, because of a loophole in the law and on the international treaty, they have to cross illegally, because if they just go to a regular border crossing, they'll be turned back.
Mm-hmm.
So to apply for asylum, sometimes you do have to cross illegally.
Mm-hmm. All right, and Tom says detention facilities. What other countries separate mommies and babies and establish internment camps for babies? What are the historical precedents? Okay, and then Adam says, UN. Any chance the UN human rights nonsense is an attempt to head off the forthcoming rebuke over the border kids? These people are despicable, and we should all be done calling anyone who supports them even passively as anything other than the same. Enough politeness. The right-wing sewer this country is becoming may be irreparable if we don't get tougher, and that's from Adam and Beacon. And then Vicky says, guest workers program. Thanks for the show. With regard to the illegal immigration problem, what about a guest worker program? In the 1960s, we had the Bracero program out west. It had some problems, but as a concept, what do you think? Well, I do know we have guest worker.
Eisenhower, program. I think, mm-hmm. put that into play, didn't he?
Yeah. No, I think we have a guest worker program, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think we do. I don't want many of our agricultural workers mm-hmm. travel. Yeah. I mean, part of the problem is that people sometimes come in under that program and then don't go back.
Yeah. So thank you, Vicky, for that one. And Anthony says, is this time of increasing economic globalization, why hasn't the United States of America looked to its own hemisphere for cheaper labor? Well, right now we're at so-called full employment. We can tell you that almost every store I go by has a sign on the front saying, please apply, and there aren't enough bodies.
Well, it's also worth remembering that globalization is partly responsible for this. I mean,
well, absolutely.
I mean, NAFTA, one of the consequences of NAFTA is that a lot of farmers in Mexico were put out of work because the country was flooded by cheap American agricultural products. So those people had no work, and they came north. I mean, that's partly why we saw as much illegal immigration as we've seen over recent decades.
And Stephen says, balancing perspective, maybe a small point, but a Morning Edition reported 2,500 families have been split on suspicions that DHS secretary identifies in press conference this week. How many have not been split up? And how many claims of being a family are suspected fraudulent or suspected trafficker or possibly terror threats? Just for perspective. And that's from Stephen.
That's a fair question.
Yeah, I mean, there are examples of people falsely claiming that, you know, the children that are not theirs are theirs. It's not an easy thing to deal with.
And Sid wants to know, who benefits financially? Cynical, I know, but my question is, who benefits financially from the retention and housing of the children being taken from their parents? And that's from Sid.
I think it's sort of like the prison argument of how much money prisons in the United States are making from housing so many inmates and benefiting from these arrests. I mean, sure. Again, we're paying for infrastructure, for staff, for the technology, for the paperwork. These are similar issues in that regard, I think.
You're absolutely right. There is a prison industry in upstate New York. We know it, and every time they try to close one. Mm-hmm.
And again, if you look at the dollars of how much has been invested in ICE since it was that subcommittee was formed, it's not cheap.
Jamie says, too often events like these on the border are just the beginning of tragic periods of human history. We then look back and ask the question, how could these events take place? Why did not anyone stop them? Once the, quote, camps are open, the only question left is, who goes in next?
Well, and this is, a global issue of what we do with people who we say we don't want in our countries. We don't have the capacity to handle. And so, you know, that's how in other parts of the world you see these tent cities that have been existing for years, that to the point where they're almost their own micro municipalities,
sure.
And in some cases, many cases, not micro. And we're going to keep seeing those issues, and we're going to see those numbers grow unless we look at this issue not only as a country, but really as a global society of, you know, what do we do with mass amounts of people moving around the countries because of the poor conditions in a lot of places, or, you know, because I think that's the majority of migrants. When you look at who's moving from one place to another, it's usually because there are human rights violations, labor violations. You look at, we haven't even begun to talk about the number of humans who are moved in the sex trafficking industry and how that's treated. I mean, that's not even on the radar, comparatively speaking.
You know, Jen and Chris, I'm sorry for interrupting. I can tell you that this is going to be interesting because we're getting a lot of letters saying what can be done about this. Mm. Now, from where I'm sitting, the one thing that can be done is a change in the people who are running the Congress. Now, you can have a lot of congressmen now, I think John Faso and others, have indicated that they are opposed to the president's policy on separating children from their parents. Nevertheless, when the people who are continuing to control things are elected each year, whether it's a Ryan or McCarthy or any of those people, there is always that moment when the people who have separated themselves on a particular policy are going to vote for that leader who is going to keep the policies going. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're not wrong about that. But this is primarily an administration policy, right? I mean, Congress is almost acting as though they're powerless to stop it.
But they are not.
They are not. No, that is true. That is true. But
and we have McConnell coming out yesterday and saying we're all for stopping this policy. Well, if you're all for stopping the policy,
then stop it.
Then
right.
Cut it out.
Right.
Speaking of stopping it, we're going to stop it right here. And
really?
Take a break for news. Yeah.
I don't want to.
Cool your jets there, Daddy-O. We'll have another 25 minutes of the program soon. We will take a break. It's the roundtable. The email address is panel@wamc.org, and it's the roundtable panel this morning. Alan Shartok, Jen Smith, and Chris Churchill. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. We'll be back. That's great. Thank you, Mike. Could I get some John Tesh tomorrow for the bumper music? Thank you. It's the roundtable panel, 10:06 here in sweltering Studio A. Alan Shartok, not Mike Spain. Let's see. It's Chris. They're both at the same paper. Chris Churchill is here, and reporter Jen Smith from the Berkshire Eagle.
Yeah, I'm from there also. I do want to issue an abject apology.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's rare.
I got something. Well, I messed up, and when I messed up, Rex and I always talk about this. I have to apologize.
Okay.
Okay, so what happened was, remember before I was talking about how I was going to be at the Berkshire Theater Group
today
in Stockbridge
at
today?
At 2 p.m.
At 2 p.m., remember that?
Yeah.
Well, when somebody asked about—
I asked you what the website was.
You asked me that,
and you
right?
said, I don't know.
I don't know. Sarah, our wonderful producer, came in with a red magic marker and put it through the absolute, on this piece of paper that I was looking, address, which is berkshiretheatergroup.org.
Yeah.
I want to apologize to Sarah and to all our listeners for my having gotten it wrong.
Okay, well, I mean, just read what's there and you'll be good to go, right?
What are you piling on?
The email address here is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and the letters have just kept coming.
They have. Janet says, during the Holocaust, parents handed their children to strangers in hope for a chance at living and better life. I have no doubt that Central and South American parents would do the same and hand them over to the U.S. government. I think you're, Janet, your tongue must be in your cheek, right? Let me read the letter again.
No, well, I think what she's saying makes sense. She's saying that the parents are so desperate
that this
may not work as a deterrent because the circumstances they're coming from are so horrific that they will give up their children if they think it means a better life for that
and
child.
Chris made that point earlier.
That's good. Phyllis says, who is operating temporary facilities on the border? Pardon me. The daily rate per child confined to tents and other temporary facilities on the border has been quoted as high as $700. That's daily. Have any of these facilities been privatized, read profit-making? During his campaign, Donald Trump recommended privatizing jails. So it's not a stretch to think that he might view human suffering at the border as an economic opportunity. And that's Phyllis from Rhinebeck. All right. And Sharon says, the children's siblings. While we're hearing all about the devastation brought about separating children from their parents, we haven't also recognized that siblings are also being separated from each other. This administration is successfully, totally isolating the children, ensuring maximum emotional damage. Consider the long-term effect of this trauma. Is it any wonder we are raising a generation of angry, damaged human beings? What do we do beyond calling, writing, marching, donating, voting, I may say? I'm desperate. Right? Anybody else? On what else to do? All right. Susan, children. Next, we'll hear that the children of parents will be billed for services, dental, or whatever. Trump will complain to the children about how much money is spent on them, as he did during Puerto Rico after the hurricane. And Karen says, children and babies. Hi, panel. Can we assume ICE and the Border Patrol do not have the medical records of all these children? What happens if one dies in custody from an allergy or any other medical reason? Of course, we won't know due to secrecy, and Chris Churchill is right. So many people wouldn't come if employers weren't hiring, including those in Congress and those nominated for positions. And we heard from Carolyn, who says, Stephen Miller on the separation policy. Last night, Rachel Maddow pointed out that reporting, Boston Globe, The Atlantic, that Stephen Miller is pushing this policy exactly to get the outrage to boost support and get the voters out in November, their voters out in November. That's right. I've said it myself. They don't see this as a political problem. They see it as a political advantage. Terrifying and heartbreaking. That's from Carolyn.
You know, just to stop you there.
I think that will backfire if that's actually what they're trying to do. But go ahead.
I think GOP lawmakers are quite concerned. I mean, I think that's why they had the meeting yesterday. They want to find it out to this situation.
Right, and one of the groups that people have wondered why they support Trump is the evangelical community, and there's been a lot of noise from them about this, and including leaders.
They don't like it.
They don't like it, right. Yeah. They don't like it one bit.
Even Ted Cruz, arch-conservative,
right,
has proposed a plan to stop the separating of families.
Right. And Franklin Graham broke with the president over this. I mean, there's been a lot.
And in my preparation for today's show, just in case you guys think I never read a newspaper, there was an article about Pence's congregation turning on him.
Mm-hmm. Well, you saw the protesters in Syracuse the other day, too.
Yeah, well, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. But this is the people he goes to church with and the people who are running the institution who turned on him. And Peter says, not one penny. Both the United States House of Representatives and the United States Senate should not allocate one penny for a border wall. Rather, they should allocate funds immediately to reunite the 6,000-plus children who are being held in captivity with their parents. The policy of separating children and their parents is so barbaric. I wonder how many private companies are running these, quote, camps and making a profit from doing so. And that's best from Peter. And Eileen says, thank you for the panel this morning. Not only are we allocating more funds to incarcerating immigrants, but the real news is the profit these centers are making. I read recently that CEO of the main centers in Texas is earning $1.5 million a year. Trump's strategy has little to do with human rights and is clearly about profit. The industrial prison complex, that's where we're growing jobs. Aren't we thoroughly ashamed? Criminal behavior on the part of our government. We are all a part of this. And Rocco writes us quite frequently from down there in Rosendale. Here's the real plan. Separate very young children from their parents, put them in cages, and give them no nurturing contact. This will create children who will severely hate the U.S. These children will be sent back to the country from which they came, where they will continue to hate the U.S. One or two of these will grow up and stand up to the puppet government that the U.S. installed in their country and overthrow this government. They could then go on against the U.S. in a military manner, should they desire. This helps one of the U.S.'s greatest exports. That would be weapons of war. So you see, this not only placates the racists here in the U.S., but it helps to perpetuate the military-industrial complex. And that's Rocco from Rosendale. Writes us a lot, almost every day.
That's a pretty long-range plan there.
Yeah, it is a long-range plan.
Marley says, why do we migrate? As an immigrant myself, the reason we all come to this country legally or not is because we are looking for a better life, either for ourselves, kids, or family members. What is happening now is evil. It is cruelly against people in need and separating them from their children. It's the most horrendous thing the agency has come up with. How did these politicians sleep at night? Very easily, I think. And then Susan says, children holding centers. I believe I heard a story on WMC that Governor Cuomo is bringing a lawsuit regarding immigrant children being held at three or four centers in Westchester area. Republicans need to speak up. This is not a left or right issue. It's a matter of right or wrong. The Republicans need to find their spines and forget their self-interest. Their constituents will reward them for defending the rights of all, capital A-L-L, children. Well, you know, this is very interesting, Susan, who makes this point. And that is these people, as I said before, are going to vote to organize for the Republicans. So you say we'll reward them, but many of them are saying, okay, I don't agree with the president on this. But in the end, electing them becomes, well, it becomes a part of the whole deal, doesn't it, Chris? No?
Not necessarily. I mean, not if they all strenuously object to it. I mean, I think many of them sincerely and honestly do. You know, I think anyone who's a parent knows that the most horrifying feeling you get is when you momentarily lose track of your child in like in a store or something like that. So I think a lot of parents, Republican and Democrat, I think she's right. I think in a sense it's not political. I think a lot of people can identify with how horrible that must be to basically not know where your kid is for an extended period of time.
I don't know. I think this whole business is, McConnell comes out, he says, all of us are against this policy, and nothing happens. What's that about? It means, okay, folks, give us credit. We tried. We're protecting ourselves by saying we're against it, but we're not doing anything to make it happen.
I think they will vote in the next couple of days. I think if you're looking for a silver lining in this whole thing, and I know it's hard to find one, it is that the condemnation of this has been so universal, and there are only a few kind of extreme voices who are in support of this thing, and they're almost all within the administration. I mean, thankfully, everybody realizes that this is immoral.
Joseph says immigration as a grandchild of Canadian, Irish, and Portuguese immigrants, I cannot help but disagree with this abominable treatment of children. At the same time, I'm curious as to who is actually locking up these kids. Could it be a for-profit prison company?
Okay. We've got several of those today.
Yeah, we have. Is that enough on that? And
no.
Then it's at the bottom it says, Christians, Mr. Sessions and Trump, you, sirs, are spawn of the devil himself. It says, I just read them.
Yeah, the question about whether or not these are for-profit companies is an interesting one. I'm not really up on it. I don't think any of us really know much about that. But that would be troubling if that is the case.
The email address here is panel@wamc.org. Here in the waning moments, Canada's Senate has given final passage to the federal government's bill to legalize recreational cannabis. Though Canadians will have to wait at least a few months to legally buy marijuana. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's government had hoped to make pot legal by July 1st, but the government has said provincial and territorial governments will need 8 to 12 weeks following Senate passage and royal assent to prepare for retail sales. Trudeau's cabinet expected to decide a legalization date in early or mid-September. The law makes Canada the second country to have a nationwide legal marijuana market after Uruguay. Each province in Canada is coming up with a few, with new rules for the sale of recreational pot. The bill passed in the Senate 55-29 on Tuesday.
I want to go to Jen on this one because... You know,
why? Is she smoking pot?
Right this minute, as a matter of fact.
Yep. I wouldn't know about that. It is awfully warm in here. But Jen, it's fascinating. You're with the Eagle, and you're covering all of this stuff.
Sure.
But it does seem that these localities, which have to make the final decisions, mm-hmm. are having a real trouble getting to go.
I think the problem here is that because it's still against the federal law. So if you're looking to set up, you know, the passage of this is based around business and industry. So if you're looking to set up a dispensary or a retail site, but you can't, you know, how do you cash a check and, you know, how do you do your taxes and things like that? I think that's one of the reasons. Obviously, we...
Is that what you're hearing in Berkshire County?
Well, I mean, the other argument in Berkshire County is obviously, like, just the concern for kids and families in a place that has an opioid epidemic, you know, is pot the gateway drug, you know. So I think all those arguments are in play, and I think that's... When you're a municipal organization and you're in charge of making that decision and setting that precedent, it's a lot that weighs on their mind. So I think that's why
they don't want it on downtown. They don't want it on Railroad Street in Great mm-hmm. Barrington, mm-hmm. or they don't want it out by the Price Chopper. Mm-hmm. Take everything in Berkshire County takes the the Price Chopper. So they don't want it on the Railroad Street, and they don't want it out there, mm-hmm. and they just don't want it.
Yeah, and I think in the case of Canada, I mean, because it's a federal law, it's a different sort of issue. I think, again, it will take some time for the different provincial administrators to decide, you know, what happens next. How do we adapt these regulations? And again, any place that's around a border, you know, with 400,000 people going between U.S. and Canada each day. I mean, as a kid who went to school in Syracuse, I remember kids in my area used to go to Canada just because they could drink when they were 18. Now...
And even younger.
Yeah.
you were not one of them, were you, Jen?
No. No comment.
I was. But, you know, I think that's a legitimate question, too, as people go back and forth and... you know, what do you do at the border there?
Yeah, and it sounds like Canada is from the stories that are out this morning, is going to treat marijuana more like cigarettes, where mm-hmm. it's just packaged and you can buy it wherever you buy cigarettes kind mm-hmm. of thing. It's not going to be like there needs to be a special, you know, special place where you go. Mm-hmm. So that'll be a different approach mm-hmm. than I think has been the mm-hmm. approach.
But
the
I think
States.
There's still those decisions. So like in Canada, for example, if one of their things they're known for is their labeling of cigarettes. So will they label, you know, marijuana the same way with their giant warning labels?
Caution, this
like
will
that.
Want you to eat Cheetos. Or, you know,
it is going to raise some interesting questions, though, because if someone is crossing, buys pot in Canada and crosses mm-hmm. into a state where pot is legal, mm-hmm. but they're intercepted by a federal authority because mm-hmm. pot is still illegal federally, mm-hmm. I mean, are they going to be arrested for that?
And I think that's why it's you can't have anything by, was it July 6th, in place, because they have to figure this out, and that's not part of any existing law.
Yeah, so but that's more of an issue for the U.S. Customs than it is for U.S. Border Patrol than it is for mm-hmm. for Canada.
Well, is it your sense, guys, that's what Sessions has planned, that he'll crack down on marijuana sales because it's against federal law? I mean, I think there seems to be an implicit understanding that that's not going to happen, but maybe I'm wrong.
I think let's ask the Political Observer here, and that would be you. Is the genie now out of the bottle? Will this, in fact, not Canada's move, but the state's moves, and in combination with Canada, lead to full legalization across the country?
Well, probably. Probably. I think it's going to be state by state, but I am concerned because I know that we have found out that cigarettes are very bad for you. And we have all kinds of people rising up and suing and saying, you knew, and when did you know? And then we haven't seen what's going to happen on the Autobahn, as we say here in America. What happens when people start crashing into each other under the influence? That could happen, just as it happens with alcohol. And somebody's going to write to me and say, but it does happen with alcohol. And, you know, how many? We were at one point up to 60,000 traffic fatalities a year. I think we're way down from that now. But it could happen. And then there'll be a counterforce coming out against it. Am I wrong?
No, you know, you're probably right. I mean, there is, you know, we'll treat pot like we treat alcohol. So if you're driving under the influence, it won't be any different. I don't know that you're going to get a wave of people who will go out because it's legal and decide to drive.
There are technical challenges there, though, Chris.
Sure, how do you
prove
it?
It's not the same. You can breathalyze alcohol very easily.
Yeah, that's
not
true.
Quite so easy with marijuana, and it'll stay in your system. So if there's a blood test involved, you may have smoked it 2 weeks ago, mm-hmm. and you're driving a car to the store and you're fine, and it shows up in your system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there, I'd love to see how Colorado and some of these other states are actually dealing with just that issue.
Well, the officer said, I smelled it.
Yeah, maybe. All right, we're about out of time here. And
no.
Gosh, it's warm. It's been very warm.
It has been warm in here, and I thank you. And I thank, again, I want to apologize to Sarah, because she did point out that if you want to come see me this afternoon at 2 o'clock, you go to BerkshireTheaterGroup.org.
All right. Alan Chartok, thank you for being here. Chris Churchill and Jen Smith, thank you as well. Thanks to everybody who wrote in. Hey, don't go anywhere. The roundtable continues in a moment.